Good morning. Are you able to hear well? Yeah, good. Back there? No? You can't hear well back there, Jim. He's going downstairs to check it out. So it's a beautiful day in a beautiful summer, and I'm happy to be here. Happy to see you. So my talk today is, I'm calling it, What Are Koans Good For? What are koans good for?
Oh,
there it goes. that is a koan. Good one, Benton. It is.
I just thought of the second line of the song War when you said that.
Okay, we're already into comment section. We just started. Tell me about that later, Chris. So what are koans good for? Last week, Rosemary talked about bird's nest roshi. Who was here for that? Oh, a lot of you. Okay. And his perspective on how hard it is, that it's easy for a three-year-old to understand ethical conduct, right? Rules for behavior. But it's hard for an 80-year-old to enact it with total consistency. Yeah, to put into practice right action, speech, and mindfulness, embody the precepts even with good intentions, without the core practices like sitting and interacting with a sangha, or if you're from another faith, prayer and acts of devotion. So side by side with the core concept of Buddha nature or original light developed in Mahayana Buddhism is the acceptance of the potency of the barriers to the practice realization of it, or original delusion, I call it. Like original sin, but hopefully without the overlay of difficulty we have with that, the negative associations we have attached to that term. But if it's original, if it's a hardwired part of us, of being human, we don't need to get so hung up on how badly we're doing or how flawed we are. That's the point of it. It's original delusion. That's part of the picture, the other side to the Buddha nature piece about being inherently awakened and being originally good, original goodness. Unfortunately, I have a scratchy throat today, so I'll do my best with that. Okay, so I want to add another practice to her suggestions for working with the challenges of our deep conditioning and our proclivity for self-delusion, and that is working with a question or a koan as a supplement to the other practices. So as I age and hopefully mature in the practice of Zen, I'm more and more aware of the strength and the depth of my own karmic conditioning and of the vulnerability of human beings in general to delusion from without and within. We have a hard time seeing clearly when our mental maps and stories are operating, how they run in the background in the default mode of our consciousness, and how they impact our lives in relationships, how our thoughts create distress for us, actually. They can, and they do. The student asks the teacher, "What is learning meditation?" The teacher says, "It's not learning meditation." The student says, a bit confused now, "What is it then?" The teacher, leaning in, yells fiercely, "It's alive! It's alive!" And then, of course, the student was greatly awakened. You could say that the entire collection of talks in The Light That Shines Through Infinity, the latest book by Katagiri Roshi and edited by Andrea Martin, speaks to this, the living energy of the teachings, the aliveness, the light shot through everything. The book of koans and commentary we're using in our Wednesday night class right now is titled Bring Me the Rhinoceros and Other Koans That Will Save Your Life. Save your life sounds a bit much, doesn't it? How can koans save your life? Save your life means reconnect you to the living energy at the basis of your life before thought. What you lived in as a baby, perhaps, or a young child, though without adult consciousness, connecting to original nature or aliveness is part of the project that we're engaging in, awakening within delusion, that project. So experiences of connecting with something beyond our ideas of the way things are gives us motivation to stay awake to our conditioning, to see it and let it drop away by being intimate with it, to stay with our practice when it's easy and when it's difficult. Koans can help with that project. So Soto Zen, as a Zen school, which is this tradition we're in here, doesn't have a formal curriculum for working with koans, as Rinzai Zen does. But our ancestor Dogen was prolific, actually, in his commentaries on the classic koans, and he often used them as teaching devices with the monks. Dogen played with the language and the meaning of classic koans from the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of 100 koans that is the first one, said to be a collection written on the paper sleeves someone wore to the Dharma discourses, the master's lectures. This master had strictly forbidden people to write anything, to record anything. So supposedly, this monk wore paper clothes and wrote it on the sleeves, and that became the cases in the Blue Cliff Record. Dogen has a seriously playful or creative approach to koans and to the language of koans, so that's actually part of our lineage, a creative approach to koans. In the case, the cypress tree in the garden, Chow Chow, or in Japanese, Joshu, says to his teacher, Nanchuan, "Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?" Nanchuan's response is, "The cypress tree in the garden." So Chow Chow, or Joshu, when he was younger, much younger than when his stories were being written down, went to see Nanchuan and asked an easy question, a question that didn't come from the depths of his own heart and longing, or frustration for that matter. It was a question about history, about the first Zen ancestor, Bodhidharma. You could say it wasn't a burning question, and maybe he just didn't know what to say, so he was playing it safe. And that's not unlike the question I asked Katagiri in Dokusan the first time during a sesshin. My question was merely speculative and about karma. And to Katagiri, I think it could have sounded frivolous. I think it did sound frivolous, looking back at it. And sesshin for Katagiri was anything but frivolous. It was serious work along the lines of the great matter of life and death. So he responded to my question with a pointed one of his own. Why are you here? Why are you here? So for the duration of our class, this session I chose my own life koan, and it's the same question he asked me. That's what I'm sitting with. Why are you here? And that becomes more and more relevant to me now, more relevant than it was then. Why am I here? Why am I alive? That's a juicy question. So I asked folks in the class to choose a life koan, a genjo koan, as it were, for their time. Here's a definition of genjo koan. According to Shohaku Okamoro, genjo means reality actually and presently taking place, or as it isness. And koan means absolute truth that embraces relative truth. Or a question true reality asks of us. So we could say that genjo koan means to answer the question from true reality through the practice of our everyday activity, our everyday life activity. So when grounded in Zen practice, every activity of daily life is an opportunity to practice the merging of difference and unity. Our situation in life, according to Zen, is living at the intersection of oneness and this particular individual expression of oneness. And it's easier for us to do that when we're doing manual labor, sweeping, weeding, cleaning toilets, even chopping vegetables, than, say, working on our computer and taking phone calls at the same time. And that's why work practice is so central to Zen, the Zen way of life, so we can practice this together in community. We can enact it and thus better take it out into our more complicated daily lives. So Tarrant says we can go at this koan, Cypress in the Garden, from the answer, either the answer or the question. The question's about Bodhidharma, the first ancestor of Zen. And that question, if answered conventionally, leads to a story about who was this guy, this red-haired barbarian who came from the West with this teaching of no merit and nothing holy? Radical inquiry through wall-sitting and dropping our ideas about things, about ourselves and others. So when Nanchuan is asked this question, he gives a sideways response. The cypress tree in the garden, as if to say, look at this tree with the eyes of Bodhidharma. You could go on your version of his journey from the West, make his discoveries your own discoveries. One explanation of koans is that the Zen ancestors sent the koans into the future for us to share their minds and their light. Wu Men, famous koan commentator, said when the koan opens up to us, we actually meet the ancestors and our eyebrows become tangled up with theirs. My older Dharma brother, Shokin Weinkopf, has ancestor eyebrows. He has really big white eyebrows. perfect ancestor eyebrows. John Terrence says, koans are a packet of light sent from the past to us today. I love that. A packet of light. The inheritance from these ancestors are the eyes with which to see the thusness of things, the as-it-isness, the light within things, within the ordinary. One of my favorite koans is, ordinary mind is the way. Chow Chow asks Nan Chuan, what is the way? Another safe question, I think. Ordinary mind is the way, says Nan Chuan. Should I turn toward it or not? If you turn toward it, you turn away from it. And then, sudden understanding. That's always in there. That's kind of, for koans, it's just, it's like, and they lived happily ever after. It is for our fairy tales. So Chow Chow, or Joshi, was a young man living with Nan Chuan, doing errands, being a personal attendant, working in the garden. Sitting was really hard for him. As soon as he sat down, he wanted to jump up. He wanted his sitting to be one-pointed, concentrated, and he wanted total clarity. And for the world to make sense and to experience the spaciousness he felt from his teacher. Not much. He didn't want much, did he? But he's a young man, so we can understand that. And he'd never done anything in his life without trying. His mind wandered. He rushed around. He was impatient with himself. He was frustrated by the gap between him and what he sensed was possible, what he desired. But this time, something about the closeness of his teacher and the timing plus the words altogether opened him up. I remember being quite a bit like this character, Joshu, when I was a young person when I came here. I wasn't that young. I was probably 24, maybe. But I also had a very hard time sitting still. I wanted to jump up and run out the door during sesshins. And actually, it took me a couple sesshins before I made it through the whole sesshin. I actually did leave. And so, if you think you're the worst, there's hope for you. Because now I can sit through them. Great progress. I really relate to this guy. So anyway, it's said that from then on, from the point of this awakening, he wasn't in a hurry. He became content with slowness and plainness. Children and trees growing. He never used energy he didn't have to use, they say. At age 60, about my age, he went on a pilgrimage, a slow pilgrimage, until he was 80. And then at 80, he decided to start teaching. He was asked to teach before that, but he said, oh, I'm not ready. He wasn't ready till he was 80. And he didn't die until age 119. This is a great teaching for Western Zen students, for me. We have lots of ideas about ourselves and about what Zen is when we come into the practice. I know I did. We've been raised with ideas about our specialness, called exceptionalism. You think Zen is cool, it's chill, it's a buzzword for just kicking back and being chill and relaxing, right? What we find is that ordinary mind is the way. And that manual labor is important, and that practice chips away slowly at our sense of specialness and at our ego operating system. And we become ordinary humans if we're lucky, and if actually, if we stay with it, if we stay with it, we let go of our need for a special identity or a new and improved version of ourselves, more spiritual, more chill, more laid back, and we let go of wanting and needing quite so much. So instead of awakening leading to ascension and transcendence of everything earthly in Zen, it means coming down to earth. It means coming way down into the body, into the experience of all the other ordinary, though extraordinary, beings, and to come to appreciate the life of serving the whole works, to that of living for the gratification of our desires alone. So that's the good news. We can all become more ordinary, and ordinary mind is the way. So now I want to share with you some of the ways we worked with the koans in class. We have been working with the koans. So in the class, we looked for a life koan, a genjo koan, you might say, something that, or a question that we could stay with to keep us company throughout the class and probably beyond, to adhere to sit with, to keep close day and night. And that's the method. And there are some other tips in case you want to play with koans. One is locating it in the body during formal sitting. Let's say put it in your hara, put it in your lower belly where you put your mudra, your hands when you sit. Or you could put it up here, or you could put it in your heart center and then hold it as a contemplative focus for part of the sitting, then let it go. Two, call it up before sleep and upon awakening from sleep. Just bring it to mind. Three, carry it around lightly, but do carry it. Four, don't try hard to solve it. Just as trying hard to stop our thoughts or attain enlightenment doesn't work well, trying hard to solve the koan doesn't work either for the long run. And some of these questions will be lifelong for us. So carrying it lightly again. Five, pay attention to clues from your life that something's moving. Odd coincidences, encounters, messages from the world. One man in our class has been going through transition in his life, in his work life, his vocation. His koan has been, what's next? In keeping it close, he's had moments of thought dropping off, colors and sounds becoming vivid and clear, and he told us last week he received an actual letter inviting him to do what he'll be doing next, in his next chapter, as one chapter ends. Not everybody had quite that experience, but it was great to hear. For me, the response to my koan has been invitations to serve the Sangha lately and the broader community in lots of ways, leading services and assisting in marking life transitions for people. The opportunity to feel the effects of my work on myself, the heartwarming, on heart-opening connections at the center of this type of work is a big clue for me that this koan is moving in my life. Life is reaching out to me with experiences that speak to it, the koan. For one person working with her koan of what is it or what now and being in a place of groundlessness after her the death of a close family member that she was a caregiver for. It's been a process of seeing and even being highly amused by watching herself want to build little cages here and there mentally for herself within this sudden freedom and emptiness of having her role drop away that she was engaged in for so long. She's able to smile at that. Another person working with the Great Way is not difficult for one who doesn't pick and choose. Found himself engaging in more picking and choosing than ever in his mind. Right? Just like Zazen. At the beginning of working with this one, he saw how difficult it is to practice the Great Way and how expectations condition the difficulty. Just like not thinking of an elephant is pretty much impossible at first, but at some point you can let go of the elephant and not think of it. So number six, seeing and letting go of reactions and judgments of what we see as a result of carrying our koan. That's also the method of working with the koan. And so koan work is creative work, creative play, though sometimes very personally challenging play. Themes of relying on the inconceivable, what to do at the point of impasse, finding the yes within no, seeing darkness within light and light within darkness, and living in the space of without, without our stories, without our mental constructs, without our mental frames, or at least the ability to see the frame, see that it is a frame, can be a really rich inquiry, a great practice to make with the assistance. You could do it with books, with a mentor, with a teacher to run it by. And I invite you to look into it if it speaks to you. Different people put different levels of commitment into the work, koan work. But I think most, if not all, have found it to be rich and even kind of fun. It's actually kind of fun. It's a great way for experienced people to kind of enlarge their practice after having done the core practices for a while of sitting and study and work, all those practices. So that's my invitation to you, and I hope that you'll try it out. And I recommend the book by John Tarrant. He's quite imaginative and creative. He's a psychologist, so there's a lot of psychological insight into his commentary. He believes that any part of the koan is what you could work with. You know, classically, there's the case and a commentary and a verse, but we're actually not approaching it that way. And according to Tarrant, and I agree with him, you can take any part of a koan and work with that part, make a question that you can just sit with. Living the questions, that's koan work. That's Zen, living the questions rather than nailing down the answers. Sometimes I like answers. So, okay, thanks for listening. And I hope you take me up on my invitation sometime. We do offer this every 2 years, the koans class, but our library is full of books of koan commentary, the major ones, and then commentaries by Western students, Western teachers. So, would you like to ask any questions or make any comments, since we seem to have quite a bit of time? Steve.
Well, I've always been a little bit, well, I don't even want to ask a question, but
no comment. After all. Okay. So Chris.
At the beginning, for those of you who...
Can you speak louder? Sorry.
I can.
Okay.
I don't usually, but...
Neither do I.
So this old song from the 60s or the 70s, War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. I thought of that when you said, what are koans good for?
That's true. That's a valid point.
I remember it was maybe 10 years ago or something, we did the Gateless Gate, and it really didn't do much for me then. But I think I've probably got a good collection of 100 from my own life that I can work on. And really, any of the teachings are fodder for koan work, the way you describe it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a passage from Genjo Koan rattling around in my brain for years.
Yeah. Yeah. So if it's rattling around in there, might as well use it. Yeah. Great. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
Lena.
Can you talk about, I'm curious how you work with the physical sensation as a koan?
She asked, how would you work with the physical sensation as a koan? Really, that's a good question. I think just sitting with the sensation, just like you sit with your koan, rather than noticing any impulse to either draw close, pull the sensation closer, or to push it away, any aversion, especially aversion. I'm thinking that's probably what you're probably talking about, a difficult sensation, right? Yeah. Well, there's conventional advice, which is go to a doctor, go to an acupuncturist. But as far as practice goes, just being with it, being intimate with it. Yeah. I like that idea. Oh, we do sit with our physical sensations in Zen. We sit with them, we observe them, we try to just become one with them and see how they change. But as a koan, you know, that could make a difficult or uncomfortable sensation much more interesting. You could have some curiosity about it. The main thing is just to watch your ideas about it. You know, see what comes up around it. And try to see if you can just be with it without any ideas, without any commentary. You know, letting that drop off. It's a great idea. It's a great way to work with that.
I was curious about the question, like almost kind of like trying to ask it, like an open question, not like what is wrong with you. More of an inviting question.
So what would that sound like?
I'm not sure, but I was curious.
Yeah, I think that could be good. You might just ask it if it's trying to tell you something, if it has some kind of message for you besides ouch. You know? Yeah. I think that's a good idea. Okay, anyone else want to comment or ask a question?
Can you pick up your own phone?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think John Tarrant and the Pacific Zen Institute people would say absolutely. They're in the process of creating new koans. Yes, you can definitely. In fact, it's much, you know, that would be your life koan, that you could, it should be relevant to your actual experience, but definitely you can make it up. Yeah. Yeah, there's different levels. There are people in the class, there's one or two that are really struggling with making it personal, you know, with making it, with talking about koans in a way that shares their own process and struggle, as well as joy that comes out of it. But I think that that's a really juicy way, is to have it be about something you really want to know, that's really perplexing and hasn't been easily resolved. Yeah. Yeah, you have some skin in the game. You're more, actually probably more outside of working with a tradition that makes koan training part of their retreats and their regular practice. I think working with a question that's particularly relevant to you is something that'll help you stay with it longer. Or finding one in the literature that speaks to you, because it's also in your experience, in the realm of your experience. Hey.
Hello. The timelessness of some koans is because we can relate to them in different ways at different times. I think a good way to see how a koan can be timeless, and the idea that I have more trouble getting to this because it meant so much to somebody else at a different time, how can it mean something different to other people at other times, is how our opinion of a dog has changed. Part of the Boo koan is that at that time, dogs were considered very ignorant. They were considered a very low life form, only obsessed with their own greed and primitive aggression and desires and such. And people thought dogs were just this extremely stupid creature. Most people I know now love dogs and consider a dog a great source of happiness and enthusiasm for being alive. A dog does not question the universe. A dog just simply says, this is my experience and I intend to enjoy it. You could take Joshu more than one way, and the reason why that's one of the most important koans is because it can mean different things to different people at different times. Like, what's your opinion of a dog? And does a dog have Buddha nature? Well, actually, that's an enduring question because there isn't a right or wrong answer to it. And the idea of, can I make up my own koan? It's also, can I see a koan differently than other people see it, because it is still equally important to both of us from our own angle of looking at it.
Good, thank you. Steve.
So has the dog become more like the human? Has the human become more like the dog?
I would say scratch it around the neck and give it a treat.
That's my koan.
I like it. So you know he was talking about the classic koan. Does the dog have Buddha nature? Or moo koan. There's another one that we could discuss about killing the cat.
Yeah, well, I,
but
my best friend in this world is a 26-year-old black cat named Nikita. And I'm sorry to cut you back off there. But I think one koan ended with the line, "Go have some tea." Very famous one. Well, I think we could also say about that koan, well, scratch it around the neck and give it a treat.
Good. Okay. All right. Anyone else? Then let's call it done. Thank you.